Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Well, Margaret, it's May already, a time for renewal.
Well, it's a time for renewal, but also a time for a little celebration. So let us say happy birthday on the 43rd anniversary of your founding of the Community Health Center on May 1st. Quite a milestone. And along with that, we do see spring finally arriving in Connecticut. And that's a good time to remind our listeners that National Women's Health Week is happening this month. And here in our organization, we make a concerted effort to reach out to women in our community with our early detection programs, prevention programs, just making sure women get the very best health services they can to maintain great health. Preventive care, such a big part of what makes good primary care so effective in improving the health of our communities and our patients.
But we have to remember, Margaret, how difficult it is for women and children around the world to gain access to health care they need, especially in areas around the world where there's unrest, poverty, and disasters, like the one that's still unfolding in Nepal. As days go by, the devastation is mounting, and the already challenged healthcare infrastructure is in great need of global assistance. And our hearts go out with them. It is going to be a long road to recovery, but there are a lot of hands working very hard to help out.
Well, that global outpouring of support from millions of people is so important. But we know in times like this, we rely on people who've made it their life's work and the life's work of their organizations. And so we thought that this would be a good time to revisit a conversation that we had last fall on Conversations on Healthcare with Carolyn Miles, CEO of Save the Children. That organization is on the ground in the toughest place of the world to help the most vulnerable among those impacted in disasters like these, and that's the world's children. So we're looking forward to speaking with Carolyn.
We certainly are. And they're working in over 100 countries around the world, and I know they're sending delegations to Nepal as we speak.
Save the Children has a long history of taking that assistance and taking it right where it can do the most good.
We've had the folks from Doctors Without Borders on our show, all with long histories of stepping into the toughest places in the world to offer life-saving intervention.
But no matter what the topic, you can hear all of our shows by going to chcradio.com.
And as always, if you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We love hearing from you.
Now, we'll revisit our interview with Save the Children CEO Carolyn Miles in just a moment.
But first, here's our producer, Marianne O'Hare, with this week's headline news.
I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines. A lot of money has been spent on pharmaceuticals, according to data recently released by Medicare. $103 billion to be exact, and the federal government data showed a mere 14 drugs cost them over $1 billion each. Most of the drugs treating common diseases among the elderly, hypertension, diabetes, depression, high cholesterol. The most frequently prescribed drug was lisinopril, a generic used to treat high blood pressure. But Nexium took the top prize. A little purple pill used to treat heartburn, acid reflux, and related stomach ailments cost the most, about $2.5 billion for 1.5 million Medicare patients. Montana has passed a Medicaid expansion bill for the 45,000 people living closer to the poverty line and still uncovered. The bill offers new Medicaid recipients help in finding work and getting help with new job skills, education, and other benefits. That provision convinced enough Republicans to join all the legislature's Democrats to vote for the bill, which the governor signed into law. And there's a new tool on the market for tens of millions of families grappling with family members with mental illness or addiction issues. It's a new book designed for the layperson and created by the American Psychiatric Association, which explains in layman's terms each specific diagnosis, what it means, and how they might better understand the mental illness they're dealing with. The new resource, Understanding Mental Disorders, Your Guide to DSM-5, includes in-depth explanations of risk factors, symptoms, and symptom management, treatment options, and pathways to success. Former Congressman Patrick Kennedy, who struggled with his own mental illness and addiction publicly, said it would have proven a useful tool for his family when he was going through his episodes. The guide is available on Amazon. I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines.
We're speaking today with Carolyn Miles, President and Chief Executive Officer of Save the Children, an independent nonprofit international organization dedicated to meeting the needs of over 143 million children in 120 countries, including the U.S. Ms. Miles first joined Save the Children in 1998. Prior to that, Ms. Miles worked as an entrepreneur and liaison for American Express in Asia, where she first developed an interest in addressing the welfare of the world's underserved children. She serves on numerous international boards and the University of Virginia's Darden School of Business, where she also earned her MBA. Carolyn, welcome back to Conversation in Healthcare.
Thank you, Mark.
You're on the show a couple of years ago, and as an organization that serves the needs of close to 150 million children around the globe, where do you see the biggest threats to childhood well-being? How does your mission at Save the Children seek to address these challenges?
Well, the world hasn't gotten any easier for kids since we last spoke, Mark. But, you know, Save the Children really works on making sure that every child has a healthy start, that they have an opportunity to learn, and that they're protected from harm. So right now, there are a lot of difficult things going on, whether you're talking about the Ebola virus in West Africa or kids that are displaced by war in places like Syria and Iraq, or kids right here in the U.S. on our borders that are fleeing violence from Central America. We're working in all of those areas. And in addition to emergencies, we also spend a lot of our time, as you might expect, as an organization called Save the Children, making sure that no child dies from something that's preventable. So we also spend a lot of our time with moms and newborns to make sure that they particularly survive that really difficult first couple of months. But it has been a really tough summer, I have to say, in terms of kids.
I think we share that sentiment completely. And I'd like to, if we could, you referenced the humanitarian crisis, the recent arrival on our borders of thousands of children fleeing strife and violence in Central America. And could you give us a bit of an update on this crisis? Tell us about the condition of the children and maybe a little more for our listeners, a little more specifics about what your organization is doing in this crisis.
Sure. I was down in Texas and was looking at the programs that Save the Children already had up and running in Texas. And, you know, I think there's a couple things in this crisis that I would focus on. The first one is that the vast majority of these kids are fleeing some really horrible circumstances in their home country of Honduras, El Salvador, Guatemala. And, you know, I sat with one little boy who was 12 and told me, you know, about getting beaten up on a very regular basis from older boys who wanted him to join a gang, and the violence that's happening and that these kids are fleeing is really, really horrendous. And frankly, I don't think as a country we are doing enough to take care of these children once they do come to our borders. We have been able to visit the detention centers in Texas and New Mexico, and you know, frankly, the conditions there for children are not what we all would like to see. We have been trying to do more in the detention centers and have not been able to, and that's been really frustrating. A lot of these kids left without anything, so they're getting clothing, they're getting food, they're getting, you know, some hygiene supplies and those kinds of things, able to take a hot shower. Those are really important. But, you know, we have to do a better job at the border, and we also have to make sure that these children get due process, because they are in many, many circumstances, they're fleeing really horrendous conditions in their country, and their stories need to be heard.
Mm-hmm. So we know that as parents, we would go to no end to make sure and as you said, there's no shortage of woes in the world that are impacting children. And certainly, you recently warned that unless there's a massive intervention or rebuilding the destroyed infrastructure in Gaza, including hospitals and schools and municipal services like water and sanitation, that even bigger humanitarian crisis is looming. How does Save the Children help rebuild infrastructure, and what innovative approaches can be utilized to better address the rebuilding of the infrastructure in Gaza and elsewhere?
I was actually in Gaza before fighting broke out, just about 2 weeks before, actually. Mm-hmm. And it's a very difficult place in the best of circumstances. It's very crowded. Now, much of that is destroyed. So there is going to have to be a big, you know, fundraising process and a big building process, rebuilding process in Gaza. And, you know, things like safe drinking water, really, really important for children. Obviously, getting kids back into school, particularly after such a horrendous emergency, that's always really, really important. And Save the Children's been working in Gaza for about 30 years, so we have lots of experience there, and we'll certainly be engaged in rebuilding there. And obviously, that war has killed many, many children, and that's something that has saved the children. We have to stand up and say something about. So we have been doing that.
I'm sorry, the list is so long of places that
I know,
are really.
But like I said, it's a tough summer.
For kids. Yep, and the problem's obviously much larger than any one organization could address adequately. How is Save the Children partnering with other organizations to address these crises?
Yes, I think one thing to point out about Syria and the conflict there, about half of those 1.5 million refugees are children. And Save the Children is working inside Syria, and then we're working in the five surrounding countries. In all of those places, we work together with both UN agencies. So in a place like Jordan, for example, there's a very large refugee camp there. There's about 90,000 refugees there. UNHCR runs the camp. Save the Children provides food every day to the 90,000 inhabitants of that camp. We work on preschool for the younger kids, so there's something for them to do. So there's a huge amount of partnership because this is it's a huge crisis. We've never seen a refugee crisis like the scale and scope of what's happening in Syria before. You can't have children out of school for 3.5 years, or they'll probably never go back.
We're speaking today with Carolyn Miles, President and Chief Executive Officer of Save the Children, an independent nonprofit international organization meeting the needs of over 143 million children in 120 countries, including the U.S. And Carolyn, the U.S. is also an area of focus for Save the Children. You recently released a report on Americans' readiness to respond to another disaster on these shores. It's been 9 years since Hurricane Katrina. So tell us about the findings of the Save the Children disaster report.
We look at these four critical factors in terms of keeping kids safe in school and childcare environments. And the good news is that when we started doing these reports, there were four states that met these four criteria. There are now 29 states that meet the criteria. You know, every day, 69 million children in the United States leave their parents and go to either school or childcare. It's really important that those facilities are prepared for emergencies. The U.S. is, I think, third on the list of countries as the most disaster-prone countries in the world, and we really have to do a better job at making sure that we're keeping our kids safe.
How are you continuing to promote the access to the basic essentials and health services in these countries that grapple with other disasters, despite these crises that keep rolling over on top of them?
I think Ebola is actually, sadly, the perfect example of what happens when you have very weak health systems. Mm-hmm. And a big intervention that we do around the world is we train community health workers. Mm-hmm. They just usually have a basic education, but they can diagnose pneumonia, for example, which is a huge killer of children all around the world. They can provide oral rehydration salts to dehydrated children from diarrhea. Again, a huge killer of children. They can help moms make a plan for their delivery, and we do spend a lot of our time trying to shore up the health systems in these poor countries.
You know, sort of going into the internal workings of an organization, they don't run on just goodwill. 90% of the funds raised for Save the Children go to fund actual programs, such a significant portion of the dollars that you raise. Tell us about the funding model, how you sustain it, and maybe sort of what the projection for the need is.
Yes, we do put a lot of focus on accountability and a lot of focus on measuring where those dollars go and how, and more importantly, how effective they were in terms of the programs that we do. So we do measure all of our programs in terms of, you know, key indicators, whatever that project is about and what we're trying to do, whether it's get kids into school and make sure that they learn and pass through the fifth grade, or whether it's, you know, train more health workers and get them into service in communities. So a lot of time is spent on the tracking of those programs to make sure that we, not only that the dollars are being well spent, but that we are learning on what works the best and we're learning also where things are not working mm-hmm. and being able to make them better. So our funding mix is actually one of the things that I think is really terrific about Save the Children is that we have a philosophy that anyone who cares about kids can get involved in the organization and certainly can figure out a way to, you know, help fund the organization. And so we have donors from a $10 donor or kids that bring in their piggy banks to, you know, an individual who gives us $10 million. So it's a very diverse funding base. We get about 30% of our funding through the U.S. government, and then about 70% of it is from corporations, foundations, individuals, and everything, as I said, from a $10 donation to a $10 million donation. You know, a lot of our partners, like the Gates Foundation, for example, pick a particular area that they really are passionate and want to work mm-hmm. on. And with Save the Children, that area with Gates is newborn survival. Mm-hmm. And so we've been working with them for 10 years. And we are, you know, in that for the long term and are really trying to drive down the numbers of kids that die in that first month, which is the biggest mm-hmm. part of kids that die under the age of five. So the needs, frankly, are always far outstrip the resources that you have. So I certainly spend time fundraising, and we have a group of people that's really what their job is all about. And what I think is great about Save the Children is that there's a place for mm-hmm. everybody to help in our organization.
Carolyn, you blogged earlier this year about your meetings with the Clinton Global Foundation at the United Nations, and you suggested that there was still too much talk about what needs to be done to address the global needs of children.
Yep.
And maybe there ought to be more shouting about the need to confront preventable causes of death and disease in children around the globe. What are the policy initiatives that you are advocating most strongly for?
And I think there's a couple of things on our agenda. One is Syria, which we talked about earlier, which I think is typically with these kind of very long, drawn-out civil, you know, war type of situations like Syria, people do tend to forget, and they tend to think there really isn't anything that we can do anymore about Syria, and both for people that are still inside Syria and also for the refugees that are outside, and whether that's, you know, providing school or continuing to make sure that these families, you know, have a roof over their head, they still need help. And so we'll be certainly pushing on Syria. And the other piece I also mentioned was on newborns. Mm-hmm. And, you know, one of the, I think, most successful things that the world has done is around child survival. And if you look at the number of mm-hmm. kids that die every year of things that we can prevent, that number has almost gone down by 50% since 1990. And that's quite a dramatic drop. But again, newborns are still the biggest part of that number, and there's still 6.6 million kids every year that die of things we can prevent. And in many countries, that 50% of that number is kids in that first month of life. So what can we do around newborns? We've been pushing with various countries to put together something called a Every Newborn Action Plan.
Mm-hmm.
So they actually have put together a plan in Ethiopia that says, here's the things we have to do for newborns in our country, and here's what the Ministry of Health is committing to do. And so almost every country now, certainly the ones that are critical in terms of child survival, have put together those plans. And so we'll be spending time at the UN General Assembly when the leaders of these countries are in town to really push that piece as well. So those are just two of the things we'll be talking about.
We've been speaking today with Carolyn Miles, President and Chief Executive Officer of Save the Children, independent nonprofit international organization meeting the needs of over 143 million children in 120 countries, including the United States. You can learn more about their work by going to savethechildren.org. You can follow her on her blog, Logging Miles, and on Twitter at Carolyn Save. Carolyn, thank you so much for joining us on Conversations.
Thank you both so much.
At Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lori Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lori, what have you got for us this week?
Well, listeners may wonder how effective fact-checking in journalism can be, especially considering that politicians repeat many false and misleading claims over and over again. We've long said that our job at factcheck.org isn't to change politicians' behavior. Rather, our focus is on arming voters with accurate information. And two new studies show that fact-checking can indeed lead to a better informed public. The American Press Institute's Fact-Checking Project published both studies. One, by a political scientist at Columbia University, found that even though false claims on Twitter hugely outnumber attempts to correct them, fact-checkers do appear to help Twitter debates become more accurate over time. For instance, the study analyzed tweets about a false claim that 2 million Americans would lose their jobs because of Obamacare. As we've reported before, the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office said that 2 million people would decide not to work, such as retiring earlier, or to work less because of the law, not that they would lose their jobs. But the Columbia study found that tweets endorsing the false claim outnumbered those attempting to correct it by a ratio of 13-1 in the first 3 months of 2014. Still, the study found the relative share of corrective tweets increased as these types of social media frenzies started to fizzle. Another study by a professor at George Washington University found that many Americans not only believe things that aren't true, but are very confident that their false notions are correct. But the study then tested whether fact-checking could correct mistaken beliefs. It found encouraging results. About a month after the initial survey, the study gave the correct information once and briefly to those who had held mistaken beliefs. It found a significant decrease in misperceptions in those who were told the correct information. So there's some support to show that fact-checking can indeed set the record straight. I'm Lori Robertson, managing editor of factcheck.org.
Factcheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have factcheck.org's Lori Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare.
Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. When Leanne Brown was a graduate student in nutritional science at NYU, she came to understand the enormous challenges of eating healthy foods while doing field work with some of New York City's more impoverished populations. And when it came time to do her thesis, she thought, why not write a cookbook of health recipes aimed at the millions of Americans living on food stamps or SNAP stipends of $4 a day?
$4 a day is sort of the general rule of thumb for around how much a person who is qualifying for food stamps would have to eat per day. So we felt like that was a more useful sort of explanation. It sort of explains like a budget range. It's sort of like a way of saying, this is a SNAP cookbook without actually saying it in so many words.
She learned that while poverty was a serious issue, the lack of access to nutritious food was also contributing to obesity and poor health in many of these families. So she conducted extensive research on shopping and healthy cooking techniques and crafted Good and Cheap, a cookbook aimed at not only teaching these families how to shop for affordable produce and healthy foods, but how to get an entire family to cook in a more healthy way.
I really wanted to arm people with the ability to walk into a grocery store and say, like, okay, this is on sale. I can totally make something delicious out of that. I know how to do that. And, you know, that's not the easiest thing to be able to do. For a lot of people, you go, this is the recipe I have. This is my list of ingredients. I better go and carefully shop for each of those. But that doesn't allow you to sort of find the deals and find the value in order to really get by on such a small amount of money. You need to be able to be adaptable.
Her thesis was so well received, she launched a Kickstarter campaign to raise enough money to make the book available at soup kitchens, women's shelters, and community health centers. And for every copy she sells, she gives one free copy to a school, a health center, or an organization that requests it.
We can't give these books away completely free, but the idea is that this is a cookbook that needs to be put into the hands of someone who really can't afford the cookbook. So that's where the idea of doing the buy one, give one, like Tom's Shoes, came from. Was sort of like, there are people out there who are really excited about this issue and have money to spend on it and who can appreciate that if they can sort of help to subsidize those who can't.
She's made her book available as a free PDF download to anyone who wants it. Good and Cheap, a cookbook aimed at the food stamp population, or anyone else on fixed income for that matter, helping to positively influence their diets, obesity, and well-being. Now that's a bright idea.
This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Margaret Flinter.
And I'm Mark Maselli. Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare, broadcast from the campus of WESU at Wesleyan University, streaming live at WESUFM.org and brought to you by the Community Health Center.